You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade. This week, I'm sharing an interview I did a couple of weeks ago with Blandine from Projet Accompagnement Solidarité Colombie or PASC. I've known about the PASC and have been seeing that group around since I was kind of a baby anarchist in Montreal. But personally, I came of age as an anarchist after the anti-globalization movement had sort of had its heyday already. And the idea of internationalism, seeing our struggles as one struggle with things happening far away, and especially things happening in the global south, has always been a relatively theoretical concept for me. I've never really traveled. I speak only English and French, and I was taught by movement elders in my youth that that was sort of okay, that I should struggle where I stand anyway in the context that I know best. I've been thinking more lately about that kind of localism and about internationalism, though, and the role of international struggles in revolutionary anarchist politics today in North America. Blandine is a person who has really given her life to solidarity with and participation in social movements in Colombia, and now lives full-time in Bogota. So I thought she would be a good person to hear from as I think about what role internationalism has or should have in my own revolutionary politics. I wanted to catch up with her at the Montreal Anarchist Book Fair a while ago, but both of our schedules made that not quite work out, so I caught up with her on Skype from her home in Bogota. I tried to keep this relevant even to people who don't know anything about the politics of Colombia, but there might be a few sections that are hard to follow. If you want to get a bit of a primer, I've shared some links in the show notes. Also, if you don't want to bother with that, stay tuned anyway. I think there's lots here for anybody who's been thinking about the concept of solidarity at all, or thinking about in what sense our struggles are global ones. Of course, if this interview makes you curious about the PASC specifically and the amazing work that they're doing in Quebec and in Colombia, you can check them out online as well. I'll link that website in the show notes too, but it's just PASC, PASC.ca. Here's my interview with Blandine.
So my name is Blandine. I'm part of a collective that's based in Quebec since 2004 called Project Accompagnement and Solidarity with Colombia. It's a collective that's been working in issues in Colombia and Quebec for the past 15 years. And that's what brought me to actually now be living in Colombia, where I keep on being an activist. And I'm still linked with the struggles in Turtle Island, or however we call it.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come to be involved with that group?
So that group started in 2004, which is a few years after, you know, like the what we would call the big start, at least in Quebec, of the anti-globalization movement, the struggle against the Summit of the Americas, all these anti-capitalist perspective. And part of that was being part of the convergence of the anti-capitalist struggles and several groups in solidarity with Latin America. So we would be like, you know, the same people organizing demos, but also sometimes in summer because we were a student going to Latin America. And we were a bit confronted with that like disconnection between like, you know, being those white activists from the north going to know struggles in the global south in summer and then do a newspaper and so forth. So at some point in one of the assembly, we decided to like focus on what we call direct solidarity, which was like being like go way deeper in the way to connect to movements and create long-term relationship with movement in the South. So many groups were created at that time, and PASC was created, as many young folks involved in student movements, student strikes, anti-globalizations. I wanted to go South, but I didn't want it to, you know, these kind of ideals you have to how to deal with your own contradiction, knowing that you won't get rid of them. So that's actually how I got involved in PASC, because like I had, you know, friends and even roommates who would tell me about the struggles of communities in Colombia, and I would relate to it. And I have to admit, I would idealize it and have a bit of a romantic perspective on it. And this is, you know, this is discussion we had in PASC for many years. So it's a it's an affinity based collective, even if it's not, you know, you don't have to be an anarchist to be part of it, even if it happens that many of the people that are part of it are anarchists. We definitely have an anti-capitalist perspective and so forth. And it's been a great collective in terms that we, you know, we stopped studying and everyone had a job and made other choices in their life. But many people decided to actually go and live in the countryside, have collective autonomy, buildings of house, of gardening, and many local projects. We were already involved in local struggles in Quebec. So that's how it kept existing for the past 15 years.
So even though it's not like an anarchist collective, what would you say are the politics of PASC? Like, what brings you all together?
I mean, there's definitely like an anti-capitalist, anti-patriarchal, feminist perspective. The also like 15 years is a long way to go in terms of political discussion. We affirm ourselves way more anti-colonial now than was the case at the beginning, because we've been way more involved in indigenous solidarity and networking campaigns and so forth. Her perspective, you know, we have a strong anti-oppression analysis that brought us to, you know, many even crises in terms of, you know, what makes sense, you know, that international solidarity thing is full of so many contradictions, is, you know, being mostly white people from Canada is also plenty, like, you know, full of contradictions. So we're actually a group that's ready to question ourselves many times and to assume what we can work on, and sometimes assume, you know, when we've been called to reflect on some issues, decide what we can or cannot work on. We also work closely on campaigns with solidarity across borders and these kind of migrants issues, ecology, let's say, many things.
And when the group formed, what was the political or social situation in Colombia that caused you to form that group?
So at the very beginning, in 2004, 2005, when we started to do accompaniment in Colombia, we actually started in a really specific region, which is a Pacific region of Chocó, which is basically, if you check a map, in between what would be Panama and Ecuador, like, and it go halfway of Colombia on the Pacific coast. It's mainly Afro-descendant communities. So it's actually, you know, the population are actually people who are called Cimarrones. It's people who've been escaping from slavery and actually build their own way of living and their own culture in the jungle, and actually had almost no contact with national government until a century ago. So it's been, you know, so it's a really particular part of Colombia. War was raging at the time. Actually, it's still raging at the time, but there's many changes in between. So you would have peasant communities, Afro communities organizing their territories, facing displacement. So literally, it was like paramilitaries and military coming and be like, we're going to kill everyone. And then we would have to use concept that we actually ate of a state and of international humanitarian law and this kind of thing, and be like, we're here and the Canadian embassy knows about the fact that we're here and you shouldn't be killing everyone. And basically it kind of worked. You know, that's kind of that weird thing of international accompaniment that's been used in Colombia, in Palestine. There was experiments of that in Iraq. So, you know, it's using your privilege against the same people, the same capitalist system that actually want to get rid of communities. So this was basically what we were doing there at the time. obvious, and the main issue was palm oil trees. So it was also a moment in which, in 2004, for example, in Quebec, people were all about like biodiesel. It was like, yeah, we're gonna get, you know, we're gonna get rid of oil, and everything's gonna be great because now we have biodiesel. So it was a bit of the beginning of campaigning against green capitalism. So it was also one of the main issue. And the situation in Colombia at the time was actually the far-right government of Álvaro Uribe from 2012, which is a government that is clearly linked with paramilitarism. Paramilitarism, just to give an explanation, it's like that way of repression that's been used in many countries in the global south, which is basically having undercover operation of the army or civilians armed and trained by the army in order to commit massacres and do what can be called like dirty war. I'm not sure there's clean war, so I don't really like that term, but that's what people have been calling dirty war. So this was exactly what was raging, specifically in regions like Chocó at the time.
And what did you, as activists from the past, do to engage with the situation? What are some of the things that you did early on?
So that was one of the debate, right? Because we, for example, we were legally recognized as an NGO in Canada, which was a huge debate among many anarchists, you can imagine. But also because we actually needed to formalize the kind of work we were doing in order for it to be useful for the people on the ground. And we started to campaign in Quebec, as I was saying, against green capitalism in general. Later, it became something mainstream, like to critique green capitalism, but it wasn't at the time. It's been something also really particular. Like, we've been changing like campaigns and way too involved, you know, depending on how evolves politics in Colombia or in Canada. And also, we started in 2006 to get involved with political prisoners, to do visits, to do some organizing around that. So that was also an issue, like to collaborate with groups that were working on political prisoners issues in the global north. For example, like a certain days calendar, making sure that Colombian political prisoners could contribute to the calendar, and this kind of networking and building bridges among struggles. So that was the case also at the time. There was the whole struggle at Six Nation. So, for example, making exchange between indigenous resistance in Colombia and the resistance in Canada, and trying to help out to build those bridges, even if it's pretty challenging, specifically because in Latin America, for whoever don't know about that, there's a pretty complicated relationship between indigenous struggles and the church and Catholicism in general. Like, you know, many indigenous communities that still have traditional authorities and so forth here, actually, like many people are Catholic. Mm-hmm. And this is something really hard to connect between like Turtle Island and the south of the continent. But it's been like some of the early struggles, let's say, and bridges we tried to build.
And when did you first actually go to Colombia?
In my case, it was in 2005. The first people in PASC went in 2004, so this was the beginning. I went for 6 months, and then I came back for a year, and then I eventually came back for 2 years, and then I stayed.
And how did that come to be? Why did you end up relocating there permanently? Was that the plan all along, or was that something that sort of happened over time?
It sort of happened over time. Several things happened. Well, one is that when I came for 2 years, it's because PASC is actually part of a network of internationalist collective in other countries. So we're part of that network, which is called Network of Brotherhood. It's like not the best name, but it was the 90s when it was started. But it's like groups that are like really similar to ours in Europe, in Argentina, in Ecuador. And all together, we have a collective house here in Colombia, so that when internationalists come in for a few months or whatever, they have a place, like they have a base, you know, where they can drop their bags and they have a dormitory. And so what we do is that one of the collective every 2 years or 3 years delegates someone to be in charge of that house. So this is what I did between 2012 and 2015. So I was in charge of receiving people from all the countries that would come to make exchange. So that could be people, you know, doing exchange with peasant organization on ecology and organic farming. That can be human rights defenders exchange. That can be work with political prisoners. That can be many things, like journalists, whatever, you know, alternative media. Like a bit of whatever can be found in the social movement. And through those 3 years, like, you know, I got involved in many things. And at some point, like, home was here. And I felt there was a place for the kind of work I can do here, which is, like, for me, it's really important to stay linked to Canada and to PASC, because, you know, it's easy to kind of forget where you come from, what are those privileges, how they can be used. But for example, for social movements here, it's pretty useful to have, you know, people who speak three languages, who know struggles in other places, and who can help out with the international networking in general.
How has the political situation in Colombia changed, and what is it like now?
Okay, so we had the far-right government, and then we had, let's say, a conservative government, and then we had, let's say, a liberal government. It's almost the same. The liberal government between 2012 and 2018 worked on the peace process. So, I mean, this is the kind of thing people can relate to. Like, people are like, yeah, Colombia, there's peace, like, FARC demobilized and this kind of thing. You know, this is the kind of thing we see in the news. So it's been what's been happening. So publicly, the government would show a more liberal democracy perspective, you know, like open to peace and to protect. Like, let's say that the perspective they have on peace is actually to give guarantees to foreign investment, right? It's not like peace as a social movement would see it as another way of organizing the state, or even living without a state, or whatever. You know, that wouldn't be the perspective. So that government worked on that. But at the same time, what's been happening since 2008, starting in the south of Colombia with indigenous organizations from the region of Cauca, in the middle of the worst moments of the war against social movements, indigenous communities organized themselves and made a huge march toward Bogota, being like, if we're going to die anyway, like, let's die in dignity. And we oppose that colonial system and we're against it. And so as they were walking toward Bogota, many social organizations that were like scared, let's say the real word, and wouldn't mobilize so much, like, decided to join. And this movement eventually grew and grew until creating massive national organized platforms that would challenge the policies of the government. That was not just indigenous, that was also Afro, peasant, union, workers, you know, like women's groups and students, like, let's say, a bit of everyone. So around 2013, 2014, 2016, and even this year, you would see massive, you know, huge strikes. So when we say strike, what do we talking about? We're talking about between 100,000 and 200,000 peasant, Afro and indigenous communities blocking the main roads of Colombia, students doing riots and protests in the cities, and all that at the same time. So that happened a few times. And so the peace agreement was signed in 2016. And there was a lot of hope from some sectors of the society that would open a space for, you know, building more progressive policies and so forth. And there was so much mobilization that people were like, yes, we're finally going to see a change happening in Colombia, and, you know, get rid of, like, raging war dirty war and so forth and get to like something else. That wouldn't be revolution. That wouldn't be, you know, whatever people call it, anarchy, socialism, whatever you want to call it. But that would be a positive change. Unfortunately, the past election was won by the far right again. You know, they frame it as if it was a war between liberals and conservatives. But as we know, for example, in Canada, like they actually complement each other pretty well in terms of politics. It's not like, but yes, it meant to go backward in terms of some stuff that the social movement had kind of won or advanced on. And it's been pretty hard because, like, in terms of war in the territories, it means a lot of repression. People are detained. There's many people in jail from social organizations and social movement. There's, you know, war is going up in many regions. There is also that whole context of the U.S. wanting to do the war against Venezuela, using Colombia as the main force, like military force for that. So it's not done yet, but it looks like it's going to happen at some point. And that wouldn't be good news for whoever don't want a full-scale war in between Colombia and Venezuela. So this is a pretty hard context in terms of hope, because even if people knew that, you know, like the peace process with the FARC or election or whatever wouldn't be the solution to all the problems, yes, there was some hope for, you know, for a new moment. And we're kind of a bit back to what it was like 15 years ago. But then some stuff have changed. The past, you know, 10 to 12 years, there was amazing mobilization, networking, organizing happening. And it's not, you know, it's not new. It's not something that happened 10 years ago, right? It's like moments, waves of where you can see this social fabric that is actually organized specifically, like mainly in the countryside, you know, because, and I'm doing a parenthesis here, there's a huge difference between Colombia and what we can think about social struggle in Canada, whatever. It's like people here are not fighting just for something in the future, but they're fighting to defend what they have. And what they have is like strong communities organizing their territories that have co-ops for production, that have their own water supply systems, that have, you know, that actually have territorial autonomy, and they're fighting to defend that. So wherever you have a really strong region where you have a lot of organizing and a lot of this model that survive despite capitalism, this is where the war get worst, because this is where like the capital actually need to crush this kind of organizing, this kind of autonomy on the territories in order to open space for what they call foreign investment. But it's like capitalism. So that would be like, end of the parenthesis, like a bit like the situation right now, like still strong mobilization. Like we just had 2 or 3 months of really intense mobilization, but a feeling of like fear of like that war that is coming back and so forth. Many people see the agreement between FARC and the government as a failure because the government isn't complying with basically anything they had agreed on. So this would be the situation. There's a lot of news and anecdotes that could be talked about, but that would be the main elements.
De tanto tiempo ya estamos acostumbrados a vivir. esta tierra con la cruz y el calvario y el rigor de la desdicha sobre el indio que se acalló, pues llegaron los mayores, traficantes de esclavos, convertir a la gente, la excusa que utilizaron fue la codicia, la que derramó la sangre y el vino, el escudo fue la cruz y la iglesia fue el camino.
You are listening to From Embers on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, or you might be elsewhere listening to the podcast edition of From Embers on your smartphone or computer. This week we're hearing from Blandine of Projet Accompagnement Solidarité Colombie, or PASC, about her project and about how we as anarchists in North America should act in solidarity with social movements in the global south. As always, if you like what you're hearing tonight, or if you hate what you're hearing and you want to send me hate mail, email fromembers@riseup.net. If you're interested in what you're hearing and want to learn more about the PASC, you can check out their website or any of the other related links that I've shared in the show notes this week. Here's the rest of that interview with Blandine. I think like the narrative that we get in the North a lot is that the violence in Colombia is not caused by the state, but rather by paramilitary organizations as well as guerrillas and drug traffickers. What can you explain a little bit, like the peace process and how that does or doesn't decrease violence in the country? Like what that actually meant and what it means now?
Well, so first clarity to make, it's like paramilitarism is a state strategy, right? Yeah. Paramilitarism is a concept that has been built by the United States in the School of the Americas, which the School of the Americas is a school that's been going on since the 40s, 50s. And it has to do with that whole doctrine, right, of the United States that, you know, they think they're the big boss of the world and specifically of Latin America. So what they do is, like, since the 50s, they've been training militaries from Argentina, Chile, Panama, you know, like all the countries of the global south. And actually now we know, because now it's been accessible, like actually the books, the training books of the 60s, for example, in which they say, in order to get rid of communism, we're going to need to use dirty war. And in order to use dirty war, like actually militaries are going to act in undercover operation where they don't look like military, but they look like something else. They can have allies from like civilians that can be trained in order to create fear, so that people won't struggle for their territories, won't struggle for whatever, call it communism or revolution or whatever. So, you know, like, and actually those manuals were pretty detailed. They were saying, like, we recommend to kill all the members of the family in front of the unionist and torture them before killing them, or, you know, like, you know, they would get in great detail. So this is an actually planned strategy that is coming from, you know, like the ruling class and whatever government represent them at some point. So this is pretty important to see. And actually, it's been something interesting here. Like there's a movement called the movement of the victims of state crimes. So the concept of state crime is pretty intense. And in Colombia, that paramilitarism had to do also with counterinsurgency. Like, you know, and they say it. I mean, there's documentaries about that where you can see militaries here being like, well, yeah, we had to kill a few people that shouldn't maybe not have been killed, but we had to fight against communism because Cuba sent us, you know, Cuba trained the guerrilla, which is actually true. Like, Cuba in the 60s, like, trained guerrillas that are still functioning right now in Colombia, because we're like FARC is demobilized, but there's still the ELN that's an active Marxist guerrilla. So actually, you know, this is a doctrine of the enemigo interior, like the internal enemy. So it's the idea that inside your borders, your army and the legal and illegal strategy have to fight that threat. So that threat, you know, now it's, before it was called communism, now it's called terrorism, but it's the same idea that you have people that are a threat to your national security, you know. And what's that national security? Well, it's capitalism. So any threat to capitalism have to be crushed. So this is, you know, this is the idea. Then, you know, narcotraffic is just one way to finance that. Because who's doing money from narcotraffic? Who's benefiting from drugs being flooded in the neighborhoods of the U.S., right? So you can see how the war on drugs in Colombia and, for example, the struggle from the U.S. against inside threat like the Black Panther Party, just to give one example, you know, are totally linked. So it's part of that same, it's that same story. So you have like old style Marxist guerrillas, you have a state that have military and paramilitary strategies, and obviously you have plenty of armed group that also are present. But this is what they're trying to do in Mexico, right? They're trying to tell you, oh, this is just violence. Yes, it used to be political many years ago, but it's not political anymore. But it being political doesn't mean we agree with the politics, right? It just means that, yes, this is a political issue, the fact that you destroy the social fabric of a territory. And so then obviously there's young people that can just, you know, get into narcotraffic or whatever. But who are the main profiters of narcotraffic are not even the small illegal groups in Colombia.
Can you tell me about some of the connections between Canada and Colombia that your group is concerned about and tries to highlight?
Yes. So that's one of the main element actually of what we're working on. So actually Canada is always trying to look like the good guy in terms of international affairs and foreign policy. But actually, if you get to study like Canadian foreign policy, as many countries in the world, their two priorities is the prosperity of Canadian and the security of Canadian. So even when Canada do international aid or kind of like try to look like the good guy who's helping out outside, their main objective is to actually get rid of any kind of opposition that could be a threat at some point. So, and the mean to do that is not necessarily, coup and war and whatever. It is sometime. But sometimes it's just like, you know, helping out with social services and building houses and, you know, stuff like that in order for people to be less poor. So that would create security for Canada. So it's not always the case. But one of the big issue with Canada is actually his extractive industry. It's pretty interesting because this is where you actually have a link with the whole building of Canada as a state and as a colonial state. Because actually since the beginning of the creation of the state of Canada, you can see that the stock exchange from Toronto actually existed before the state existed. So they actually, the whole building. And, you know, when we talk about stolen land, when we talk about colonialism, this is what we talk about. We talk about a state that's based on the fact that they need huge amount of resources in order to make money, in order to maintain a ruling class that is the same ruling class, being the conservatives or the liberals for so many years in Canada. So this is the same logic that you can see is applied to Colombia. Concretely, how does it look like in Colombia? Well, for example, in the 90s, SIDA at the time, who was the International Development Agency, mm-hmm. actually helped Colombia to build their legal framework for mining. So it's called the Mining Code, which is actually like the protocol, like the state recognized protocol of how to mine in Colombia. And actually Canada paid for the lawyers of the main Canadian mining companies to help Colombia to build up that framework. So right now, the law in Colombia is the law that was recommended, because obviously, you know, it would be it's not imposed, but you know, when you have someone like Canada helping out, you can assure yourself that you didn't have any choice to say no. That actually build up the mining code. Many similar things happened with other extractive sectors. So actually what you can see is right now, Colombia like is one of the main country where actually oil companies also are really pretty active and present. So this is one of the huge issues. Then the other one that was exactly on the same line is the free trade agreement. So there's a free trade agreement that was put in place in 2011 between Colombia and Canada. And that free trade agreement, its objective is to actually protect foreign investment. So, for example, right now you have three Canadian companies that are suing the Colombian government in the legal framework of the free trade agreement in order to ask for billions and billions and billions of dollars for profit they could have made if they were authorized to actually exploit some resources. So let's give some of the examples. There's a national park in the region of Saint-Urbain, in the northeast of the country, and the Kenyan company at some point was said, because like people organized and said, well, this is a national reserve, you can't actually get all the gold and make an open pit mining here. So then there was, you know, long-term like legal process. And at the end of the day, the decision was made by the tribunals that the park lines had to be better defined in order to protect the area. And the company ended up losing some of the hectares they wanted to exploit. Not all of it, just some of it. But with that excuse, they asked for billions of compensation for the profits they could have made if they had had the full permit that they didn't have at the end of the day. So it means that any law that looks for to protect environment, society, or whoever can be sued by Canadian companies to say, oh, we could have made that profit. You know, it's not even a compensation for whatever cost they had to engage and then were lost. No, it's speculation on the profit that could have been made. Similar situation you can see in the Amazon. And another case that's pretty interesting is the Gran Colombia case, in which actually the company, the gold company, Gran Colombia Gold, is suing Colombia's government because they say they failed to protect their investment because there are still guerrillas, social strikes, and rioting from the workers happening. So it's a company who's actually kicking out of their land traditional artisanal miners, which is like small-scale mining. They kick them out with the help of the army and so forth. And because people keep on coming back and keep on rioting and, you know, organizing protests and whatever, then they sue the Colombian government with that free trade agreement, saying like the Colombian government failed to protect our investment and we're losing money because of those protests, right? And so that would be another one. Then there's plenty other examples, but I think those two ones give a good understanding. So Canada converts itself as a judicial paradise for mining, oil companies, and all the extractive sector companies, because nobody's going to sue them. Canada is going to fight for them to defend their rights to steal all the time. So this is why actually like 80% of the mining companies of the world are actually based in Canada. Not because we're actually based there. They don't have anyone employed there. No one's working there in most of the cases. But it's just we converted ourselves as a paradise for them. And it's not something... And when I say converted, it's for the international level. Because actually nationally, it's always been the case. So that would be like... So this is like the main... things. And one of the campaigns we've been working on in PASC is it's called targeting Canadian war profiteers in Colombia, because it's actually how we call them, war profiteers. Because those people, I mean, I can't give an example in which I can prove that a Canadian company actually paid someone in order to get a unionist killed. I could in the case of Coca-Cola, because we've been condemned for one of those things, but not those mining companies. But we know that the kind of conflict that this project generate on the ground is the one that is actually filling out the war. So there's war because of those policies and those foreign investment. Whenever they try to tell us that actually human rights is going to get better if foreign investment get better because development, capitalist development is the best. But the proof wherever you check on the planet is that it's exactly the contrary. War actually happened because we look to steal the resources and people won't let them. And this is why there's war.
Hmm. So other than like moving there full time and immersing themselves in social struggle in another country, what can internationals, for example, people in Canada do for a situation like that, for struggles like that, that are far away?
Like, I think the internationalism, the whole idea is like, it doesn't matter where you are, where you live, it matters where you fight. So it doesn't matter what's your nationality or where you end up being, but it matters how you fight and how you relate with the struggles where you are. So I think it's not an issue, you know, of like moving, you know, having to travel or having to move somewhere. It's more an issue of having a systemic analysis of those struggles.
When we hear about something that's happening, like in this case in Colombia, and we are here in Canada, and we can see that there are political connections between the enemies that we're fighting, how can we also make those connections as activists or as anarchists or whatever?
I think those connections can be made in many ways. Like, for example, you know, if you're going to target companies that are involved in tar sands or whatever campaign you're involved on, you can see what are the links. What is this company doing in, you know, what's been called Middle East or Latin America or Asia? You know, you can look for those bridges. And if your collective, if your community, if where you're organized do not have the time to be like full-time activist on internationalism because you have plenty of stuff to do wherever you are, it can just be, you know, just checking. Like many times first group that work on those issues that are going to be interested to be like, oh, we're going to build those bridges. And those bridges are actually pretty like strong whenever they happen, because also they allows you to, for example, sometimes, I don't know, you're on your, like wherever you live, a small town, a village, you're opposing a mega project, a mine or whatever. And people are going to be like, I don't want the mine or the pipeline here in my village. And you're going to organize with people around that. But sometimes, you know, because of culture and politics and stuff, they don't give a f*** if a pipeline goes somewhere else. As soon as it's far away from their home. And this is where you get to analyze that the problem is actually capitalism and patriarchy and the whole way we relate to the state and to the land and so forth, is when you can give them and share example about those same companies and what they've been doing somewhere else and be like, this is not okay that if there's no pipeline here, actually the pipeline goes to that indigenous community, or actually the pipeline goes to Africa, or it goes to Colombia or to wherever, right? So I think it's actually pretty useful in order to be more radical and radical in terms of going to the roots of the problem, see internationalism as a perspective for everyone. It's not something for people who like to read stuff about people somewhere else in the world. And also there's ways to relate to that. You don't need to travel. Like you can, for example, I was thinking, you know, check the analysis, or many people, and when you speak English, it's easier because many groups in the world make the effort to translate some of the stuff they do in English. So you can actually read about the analysis they have on their struggle. I don't know, like the Kurds or people in Brazil or wherever, and actually relate to it, even answer and start a dialogue and be like, okay, so this way you analyze your local struggle. I see there's links with mine, and you can publish stuff together. You know, like there's many, many, many ways to make that real.
Do you think that some contexts are more likely to become like revolutionary situations than others? I think like a lot of people, especially in like anti-globalization type like moments, believe, I think perhaps rightly, that that in the global south, it's more likely that a social revolution is going to happen, and that there's some kind of responsibility there as well for that reason. Do you think that that's true? Do you think that Colombia is like more revolutionary than Canada, I guess?
Well, I think that the short answer would be no. And why am I saying no, even if it seemed pretty obvious that the answer would be yes? It's because obviously the contradiction created by capitalism and so forth is always stronger in the periphery, in the peripherias, than in the center, right? If you're in the center of the power in a city in North America, you're not necessarily going to feel, especially if you're middle class and whatever, you're not going to feel the impacts of capital the same way that maybe someone's going to feel on a reserve, for example. So obviously there's places where you're more oppressed, where you're going to feel the need for the fight on an everyday basis, and you don't have a choice. This is not something you can do or not. But it has to do with class, it has to do with gender, it has to do with race, it has to do with geopolitics and wherever you are on the planet, right? So obviously it happens that in Colombia you have more like Black, Indigenous, and peasant people that are really screwed by the system and need to organize in order to survive, because if not, they won't survive, right? So yes, you happen to have, like, in terms of population, more people. But then if you're taking, like, in Canada too, like, you could see the same examples. And I remember, like, something funny. Whenever we gave workshop with PASC, like, we're invited all the time to, like, many places to do workshops. And, you know, we would do workshop in cities and around cities. And whenever we would go, for example, to Gaspésie, which is, like, you know, 10 hours away from Montreal driving, people would relate to what's happening in Colombia way more. And I mean, the way of life in Gaspésie is far away from whatever you can see in the jungle of Chocó. But they would relate to it because they're actually screwed in the same way and mechanism we are. So this is when you can get the point that it's actually one struggle. And obviously we have to be aware of privileges based on gender, class, you know, like nationality and all those things. And we have to deal with those contradictions every day. But this is why. I mean, it's not because I see, you know, things that are like, for example, in Kurdistan, like you can get to, you know, see, you know, the full scale revolution happening in Rojava. Obviously, it's more obvious than whatever can be happening in Turtle Island right now. But then I don't think it's more or less revolutionary. I think it's a different moment, different stages, you know, different intensity, but it's definitely the same.
I think that many people in my life share a desire to build an analysis that's international and to understand the global links that surround with the things that they're doing and the actions that they're taking, but ultimately decide that it's better to sort of fight where we stand because we know the context at home better, and that in that sense, maybe people are like localists, although not in a like not in my backyard, like only my turf matters kind of way. What do you say to that as someone who has like really given your life to like actually participating internationally?
Well, I think we need each other. It means like my own struggle and the struggle I'm doing with PASC wouldn't make any sense without actually people from my collective being involved in struggling against a mining project close to their small town where they're living in, right? And this is what makes sense to what we're doing. Like, we shouldn't let internationalism in our global struggle in the end of what has been called like the solidarity industrial complex. I mean, this is the fact that we're linked to grassroots organizing, to organized communities that are defending land, that are defending their territories. This is what makes sense to build the bridges. So who, like, obviously, in terms of task division, at some point, like, I'm more, you know, those typical activists that spend too much time with the computer, basically because we're bad at gardening, in order to make links between those grassroots organizing struggles. But you have to be part of them, right? Like, I mean, you have sometimes to, like, go and spend your summer building house with your friends that are actually building their, you know, alternative housing and so forth in order to get linked to that. If not, you know, you just end up being, yeah, NGOs. And NGO, my definition of NGO is like people who struggle for things that don't affect them. Like, I mean, you need to be organized. It can be a feminist group. It can be your neighborhood organizing. It can be whatever, wherever you are. you organize with the people wherever you are, and then you build bridges. Some people, we spend more time working on those bridges for many things that happens in life, and some people spend more time on the local things. Mm. But I don't think this is something separated. I think this is something that have to be linked and that is linked.
So the majority of social movements in Colombia are not like anarchistic movements. How do you, as a person with anti-authoritarian politics, relate to struggles or movements that might have some elements that are authoritarian?
So it's actually been a surprise for me, but obviously I'm involved here in movement that I wouldn't call authoritarians, but yes, that have a way of seeing the division of tasks in a way that we could see as hierarchical, right? So you're responsible for international relations, you're responsible for this, you have a team. Like, it's a collective way of working, but yes, there's a division of tasks. And actually, I haven't seen more or less problem of authoritarian issues than in actually informal anarchist organizing. And it's even been easier for me here to challenge authoritarian patterns and way of being, because if you know who's in charge of what, and that person is being authoritarian in the way they're doing it, I think it's easier to challenge it when you know who to challenge it to and who call out on some things. Because sometimes, like, informal organizing actually opens a space for many, you know, flaky authoritarian way of acting that we have no way to challenge, and actually people just drop off because they don't know how to face it. It doesn't mean that people don't drop off here, like, it happens everywhere. But, I mean, I think the struggle against authoritarianism is the same in anarchist organizing than in any other organizing. Well, I mean, I'm not organizing a party or whatever. That might be harder. but I think there's space to challenge it in many ways.
But what about, like, groups whose vision for the world is very different from yours? Not so much in their practice, like how they organize, but in terms of, like, what they would want to see happen.
Well, I think the state issue is one of the main element. And actually, I can't be thankful enough to the Kurdish struggle for the kind of analysis we do about the state. And I've been challenged, you know, like, well, I mean, I'm not the kind of really theoretical anarchist, like, I'm not the one who have read all the books and whatever, you know, I was in a scene of people that were activists that we call ourselves anarchists, and we can relate to those values and so forth, but we're like, I wouldn't pretend I'm the more intellectual on those issues. But then it's been actually interesting to challenge my values with other people, even, like, just, you know, in my collective house and roommates. So I had a roommate who was from an organization, like, you know, from a social background that didn't know the way we were living. And they would say, well, I mean, you're against the state and against authority and so forth, but you have so much rules that you don't tell us about before, and we just have to suppose them and guess and understand them. And if we don't understand the rule, then we're bad people, you know? So they would challenge me on some stuff that were, for me, so obvious that I actually liked. Even the conversation around the state. I mean, like, we have plenty of contradiction. Like, we want, like, you know, I'm not against healthcare. Like, I'm not against the fact that everybody get access to health or education. Obviously, I'm against the state controlled perspective on it. Mm-hmm. But so I'd rather felt that even, like, you know, people that can call themselves, like, socialist or whatever, like, actually I engage in really interesting conversations around some stuff that I thought were obvious for me, but then I had to work on it so that it would keep on making sense, kind of. Not sure it's clear, but.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that living in a context where there has been, like, armed and militant struggle changes your perspective on that kind of thing? I think, like, here often people, many anarchists, like, oppose themselves to, like, to that kind of struggle because it's, like, specialized and professionalized and not anti-authoritarian, and then, like, see themselves in opposition to that in terms of, like, tactics or whatever. Does that feel different for you in a context where, like, that is, like, more of a, like, real lived experience?
So definitely it makes more interesting the whole debate around, like, around violence and politics, because there's actually, like, strong lived example of what it means. So it's a good way not to romanticize at all the use of violence for a political mean. So I think that's something that's enriched a lot my analysis. Also, I would say, and it sounds contrary to the beginning of the answer, is that, for example, working with political prisoners, you end up visiting people that are actually from armed groups. And you talk to them, and some of them sometimes can sound pretty social democrat. And you're like, oh, I thought if people would take guns, it's because, you know, they wanted to do the revolution. And sometimes in Colombia, in Colombian history, well, not all armed groups have been revolutionaries, and sometimes there were leftists that were in favor of, you know, democratic reforms, and they could take arms for that. So I think it's a good way to not romanticize and to understand in a more complex way how armed struggle can play a role in the history of Colombia, but also in the history of the world, right? And get to analyze, you know, in what's been called Middle East, like you can see how groups pass from being terrorist group to being rebel groups from the analysis of CNN all the time. And so you get to understand more like, okay, what's the complexity of how and why those groups organize themselves and around what and so forth. So I think it's been interesting for that.
What do you think that radicals in Quebec or in Canada should do differently in terms of how their practice relates or doesn't relate to an international context?
So, I couldn't tell because I haven't been there for the past 7 years and I wouldn't feel it's fair to say what they should or shouldn't do. Recently at the Anarchist Book Fair, I could hear about the needs that people would express they had in terms of unity, in terms of not just being a small scene of people amongst the convinced, but to build unity with social sectors, with socially organized sectors of society and so forth, and to build common strategies. And I think relating to international struggles, talking with and about what's happening in Kurdistan, in Palestine, in many countries in the world can open up a space for that. I think that can be useful to see what's happening in other contexts in order to see with new eyes our own reality, I would say.
I think it can be sometimes hard to find information that we feel like we can trust about struggles that are going on in Latin America or elsewhere in the world, because there's so much propaganda from like various state and non-state actors, and also because of language differences. How would you suggest we go about it from here? What should we read? Who should we talk to? Like, how do we find out what's going on?
So whenever we check news from that, you know, are financed by governments and so forth, I think we have to use a diversity of it, right? So if I check CNN, I'll check also Russian Today, and I'll check also Al Jazeera, and I'll check also Telesud. So this is when you have time. Then when you don't have that time to check and make a comparison between all those things, and that you need to access information in English, I would strongly recommend something that's not very original, but I mean Democracy Now! On their page, democracynow.org, I've been doing an amazing work in the past many years to give access to information on international issues. But also, I would recommend two other webpages. One is peoplesdispatch.org. It's actually a news online. It's organized by social movements. It's social movements that put activist journalists at the service, let's say, of that platform. So, for example, today you have news about Brazil, Italy, Uruguay, Sudan, you know, like, and this is today's front page, and they have news every day. So I think this is a great source. And for debates, I would recommend there's also international platforms have been organizing around an investigation institute called The Three Continental. So it's like the3continental.org. They have a weekly newsletter that usually bring up debates about what's happening. There's many news from India also and other countries. And they have notebooks and they have reports on situations. So we just published one about Venezuela. They published one about India. They've been, you know, they've been publishing many things. So I think it's a great source.
Hmm. And if people are interested specifically in what's going on with PASC or in Colombia right now, how can they find out more about your group and what you do?
So they can, you know, like usual things, like on the webpage, PASC.ca, right at the, you know, if you put a slash EN, you're going to get straight to the English part. If not, you're going to see at the head of it, the option for Spanish or English webpage. You can follow us on Facebook and so forth. Also, you can look for groups maybe close to where you are. There's groups involved with Colombia Solidarity also in Toronto and in other places in Canada, I think.
En la incursión, Lucía Vargas, capital, Diana Bella, ajá, así son las cosas,
desde la ciudad de Bogotá,
2005, por razones de Estado,
por razones de Estado de Bogotá,
una nación que entre las cenizas se ha perdido, el tricolor refundido, entre los bolsillos de los altos mandatarios quienes han vendido su alma, el cuerpo y la tierra de un pueblo que clama gritos, justicia, comida y ante todo libertad. Suramérica no debe ser provincia de la gran manzana que de por sí ya está podrida. Preferiría que la causa del efecto de la dignidad vendida no fuera la carencia de la conciencia, porque
no hay ni solución ni espera. Esperan que el tiempo devuelva todas las maneras de conciencia y que la amnesia permanezca como la bandera. No hay tampoco esperanza cuando se lavan las manos los mandatarios, libres de cualquier obstáculo
para ejecutar el intercambio monetario, no humanitario, para matar a sangre fría y acusar al terrorista, pues así se llama todo aquel que no comparte sus políticas. Y mientras tanto,
el pueblo humillado sigue día a día regalando todo su trabajo, paga impuestos al gobierno por ser explotado. La educación tan solo es de unos cuantos privilegiados, el resto solo aprende lecciones de esclavos,
todo a causa de un libre tratado
que consiste en venderle el alma al diablo, el pago que nos devuelvan las cadenas perdidas en la independencia,
para seguir paso a paso al infierno de una colonia de un país norteamericano.
Norteamericano.
Sí, así fue.
Libre comercio para vender el alma,
esclavos y actores de nuestra propia facha.
Pierdo la vida y no encuentro la calma.
La libertad humana es lo único que queda cuando la guerra se acaba.
Por razones de Estado no esconderé mis palabras.
Argumento lo dicho con unos cuantos hechos.
Explícito es el veneno.
No nos matarán con balas, pero de hambre moriremos.
Entonces, ¿cuáles ventajas poseemos?
Lo único propio en estos momentos es
la fortaleza de los héroes muertos. Tampoco el oro, una pertenencia de este pueblo,
ni de los ríos el agua que colma la sed de educación y empleo.
El tricolor perdido está en nuestro miedo
y en las manos vacías de este gobierno.
Entonces, ¿cuál libre comercio?
¿Cuál progreso? Si las máquinas activas requieren de esclavos en silencio.
Si no se vende el alma, pues se vende el cuerpo.
Y yo me niego a que mis rimas, fuerza y vida
se inunden y se pierdan en una ideología ajena.
En estos versos que me expresan,
tengo yo el poder y mis palabras las que gobiernan.
Entonces, mi revolución será en letras.
Resistencia, el conocimiento es misil para acabar con falsas influencias.
Por razones de Estado, esto a ustedes les interesa.
Libre comercio para vender el alma,
esclavos y actores de nuestra propia facha.
Pierdo la vida y no encuentro la calma.
La libertad humana es lo único que queda cuando la guerra se acaba.
Por razones de Estado no esconderé mis palabras.
Libre comercio para vender el alma,
esclavos y actores de nuestra propia facha.
Pierdo la vida y no encuentro la calma.
La libertad humana es lo único que queda cuando la guerra se acaba.
Razones de Estado no esconderé mis palabras.
Por razones de Estado, Lucía Vargas, Diana Bella, desde Bogotá, en la incursión, Las Brand, AR. Esto fue Por razones de Estado. En
revolución lirical hasta el final.
I'm going to make those pompous academics regret kicking out such a genius. Deciding to build my lab and do my research.
The Time Talks Podcast.
Have you ever stared at a 500-page book and wish you could just talk to the author about their ideas instead? If so, the Time Talks Podcast, part of the Channel Zero Network, is for you, where we discuss history, politics, music, and art with an anti-authoritarian and anarchist perspective.
The Time Talks Podcast.
What's this light? I feel different.
The Time Talks Podcast.